Diary of Doom.
What's going on, fanatics? This is the latest entry in the Diary of Doom as we look back on the rich history of doom metal and its sister sounds based on the recounted tales of its fanatics. Every week we will have a different guest spin their yarn. Before we get into that, you can follow us on Instagram at Diary of Doom, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Diary of Doom, and now you can subscribe and listen to the podcast on Podbean. We are on a new hosting site, but actually more importantly, you can subscribe to it on both iTunes and Spotify now. So go over to your respective streaming site and download the podcast. Costs you nothing. If you have a question or want to pitch something to me or whatever, you can fire off an email to diaryofdoom1968@gmail.com. And now that we've got all that out of the way, introduce our guest for the week is big shit photographer in my eyes. Like, I've been a big fan for like a long time. Mr. Tim Bugby, you know him better on the interwebs as Tinnitus Photography.
Well, thank you, Dylan. Happy to be here. Thank you for the kind words. It's always nice to hear when people praise your work. So appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, I think I probably got like clued into your photography probably like after I graduated college, because I felt like kind of around that time, and I guess we'll kind of get into it. That seemed to be sort of when, at least to me, photographers started showing off more of their work on like platforms like Instagram and whatnot. So that's kind of where I started. I was like, man, this is like a whole other world. Obviously, you're a concert photographer, and that's pretty much what you're well known to, as far as I know you. But you're also obviously, like, in addition to being like a pro photographer, you're also a huge music fan, and you have a pretty wide spectrum in terms of like the music that you enjoy and go see. So I guess kind of to go back to the beginning, like, what were your earliest experiences with music?
I can remember the first record I ever bought, and that was a copy of Blue Oyster Cult's Secret Treaties. I think I was, I don't know, maybe like 10 or so at the time. I remember buying it at Leechmere. I don't know if there's any New England listeners out there, but that was an old department store that closed probably like 2 or 3 decades ago now. But I still have a copy of that record, and it's still one of my favorites. BOC was always a very interesting band. You know, I took some cues from my older brother, Sean, who was 4 years older than me. He had a lot of classic, you know, hard rock, you know, Zeppelin and Queen and stuff like that. But they also like Southern rock a lot. So the first concert I went with him, and I think I was in 7th or 8th grade. I think it was 1978, 79. Went to see the Outlaws and Molly Hatchet open. So whole bunch of Southern rock redneck action going on there. It was super fun. I think it was probably the first time I ever smelled any kind of marijuana in the air. It was a full concert experience.
Cool. So that's kind of like where you cut your teeth. And then, you know, from there, obviously you just started, you know, you probably went on a path similar to so many people, just like, you know, drinking it all in and whatnot. Did you have like a specific record that kind of broke you into, you know, rock and roll? Like, was it that Blue Oyster Cult record, or was there another one that was like a, you know, your gateway into it?
The BOC one was the first one I bought. My dad had a bunch of records that were pretty influential on me. You know, he had kind of, you know, the kind of the expected records in the collection, you know, a bunch of Steely Dan and Crosby, Stills and Nash, you know, that sort of stuff. He did have a copy of Paranoid, which was cool. I think that one, and he had Agents of Fortune too. That might have been kind of what turned me on to BOC. I remember him playing, there was a live Santana record and Doors, a couple Doors records. So, you know, he had decent taste. Very different from my mom. My mom was a piano teacher, and she just kind of listened to, you know, classical music and a little bit of pop music. She didn't really listen to music at all. Mm-hmm. But in terms of a record that kind of opened my eyes, there's probably a few. I might go off on some tangents on this question.
Sure.
In high school, I was just kind of starting to learn about punk rock, and I remember getting a copy of the Dead Kennedys record, Fresh Fruits, Rotting Vegetables, and the lead-off track, Kill the Poor, you know, starts with Jello in his kind of quavering, you know, kind of weird voice. God told me to skin you alive, and I'm like, what is this shit? It was like kind of creepy and like, wow, this is a whole new world. And then it, you know, just goes into this, you know, hardcore tune, which I always thought the Kennedys were just more than hardcore. They had a lot of other things going on. They were definitely a formative band, you know, in terms of opening horizons. And I did get to see them once when I was a freshman in college, which was it was a good show, and it was kind of funny too. To this day, I have no idea if it was scripted or not. but they, after I think Verbal Assault played, and I can't remember the other band, DK's are late, like 15, 20 minutes. Finally, Jello comes up on stage and he's like, we haven't seen our drummer in a couple of days. We have no idea if he's in a dumpster in New Jersey or not. So if anyone knows how to play any of our songs on drums, meet me side stage and we'll get the show started. So they had like two or three people go up, and like, I think a couple of people, you know, nailed their songs pretty well. One guy like was terrible and they stopped mid-song and kicked him off. And then eventually Peligro just kind of strolls through the door, through the club, in the crowd. He's like, hey, I'm here. And then they just started the show proper. So that was pretty funny.
Wow. I never got to see Jello with the Kennedys. I saw a version of the Dead Kennedys. I don't know who was fronting them, but it was not good, to say the least.
The Kennedys are playing a new venue in Boston in, like, I don't know, a few weeks that I've never been to yet, but the Pixies played there, and I imagine the thing's pretty big. I think like Rick Ross and Freddie Gibbs played there. It's got to be at least like 1,500 people. I have no idea how they're going to sell any tickets unless you just give them away. It seems like a really weird place to book that band.
It seems really weird because the place that I saw them was like small. I think it was Andrew WK's place in New York.
Oh, nice.
Santa's Party House, yep. I think is what it was called. And it was so bad that we left.
Yeah, it sucks when bands kind of have an acrimonious split and they, you know, both sides trying to pick up the pieces. Yeah, I don't know. I think if you're the singer, you kind of hold a trump card a little bit because it's somewhat easier to replicate guitar tone or drum sound and, you know, just the song structure. But the vocals are always a bit more unique. So, you know, you can always think, oh, this doesn't really sound like the band that I remember in my head.
Yeah, and stage presence is a whole part of it.
Oh, for sure.
That's why, you go with the classic example, like Iron Maiden, you know, like, yeah, sure, the first guy is actually quite good. I like him a lot as the vocalist, mm-hmm. but like Bruce Dickinson is that band, you know?
Right, yeah. Yep. Yeah, he came in and kind of made it his own band, you know, he's got the vocal, you know, power, and he's got the stage presence. Like I said, I finally did get to see them a few years ago, and yeah, I was blown away. It was a great show.
Oh yeah, they're always good. They just went around last year. Saw them last year. Definitely a little bit slower, I think. Although not yeah. Bruce, man, that guy's crazy.
Well, Steve looks like he hits the gym on a routine frequency. He looked like he was in good shape.
I mean, they're all like still running around, and they're in like their like late 60s. It's still quite impressive.
Well, when I saw them, it was in the middle of the summer on a hot as fuck night. It was probably like, I don't know, in the 80s. And Dickinson's wearing his like army boots with like a heavy pullover in fatigues, and he's running around all over the place, going like on either side of the stage, up the ramparts, jumping over things. It's like, damn, he's like he's a wrestler trying to, you know, drop weight for a bout.
Yeah, like I'm getting tired just watching him. So your concert photography goes back to 2006, and I'm not sure kind of like where the paths sort of diverge for you, because, you know, I kind of look at it, the body of work that you cover, you know, kind of goes in two separate directions, and I would imagine that part of that had to go with going to like the ATP festival back in the day. Mm-hmm. And whatnot, because then you also cover something like Boston Calling, which is, you know, not most of the music that I listened to personally. So like, was there like a specific record or band that really brought you towards like the doomier side of things, the heavier side of heavy metal?
Yeah. In fact, it can be traced directly to Boris.
Okay.
I didn't listen to metal all that much, really. You know, I still was a fan of BOC. In college, it was basically all indie rock for me. And then I discovered jazz when I got out of college after reading a great article on Sun Ra on the Boston Globe years ago. But again, and then I kind of went into a bit more of the esoteric indie and experimental noise stuff. A couple of good record stores in Boston turned me on and stuff like that. But when I saw Boris on the Pink Tour in 2006, and they blew me away. I was not ready for that at all. And that kind of like was the gateway drug to go into, you know, look at what other bands were on Southern Lord and then kind of branch off from there.
Okay. What's the record store? Is it Newberry?
Newberry Comics is a good one. The one that I was referring to about the influences was a store called In Your Ear. So I went to school in Providence, and I think there still is. I haven't been to Providence in a while. There was a store there that I bought a bunch of stuff at. Rick Mank, who was the drummer for Velvet Crush, used to work there a lot. And then when I moved up to Boston, the one in Boston was really good. Conrad Capistran ran it, along with Robin Amos, and Bob Fay was there too. So Conrad plays in Sunburn, Hand of the Man, kind of like a freak psych collective out of Western Mass. Robin was in a band called The Girls, and then he was in Cul-de-Sac with Glenn Jones. Girls were like a kind of an early no wave band that put out a single on Per Ruba's label in the 70s. And then okay. Bob Fay was with Sebado for a few years. Mm-hmm. So those guys turned me on to a lot of good shit that I would never have found on my own, or would have been a much harder discovery process.
Okay, right on. Does this coincide with you getting into like photography, or was that predates this, I assume?
It does. Yeah, photography was kind of a late thing for me. I was a writer before I was a photographer. So I used to do some writing for, there was a little fanzine out of Boston called Pop Watch. I knew the woman who put it out, Leslie, got to be friends with her. I think Bob Fay did some writing for her too. I might have met Leslie through Bob. I can't remember now. But she put out, I think, 10 issues all told. I think I hopped on issue maybe 5. So that was cool. Did record reviews and the odd interview here and there. And then I started working for the Big Takeover too, contributing, you know, same thing, record reviews and the odd interview for Jack Rabbit's mag, which was started out as a punk zine. And, you know, he's got a pretty big interest in, indie rock, Britpop, that kind of stuff. And but he also threw me out a bunch of bands I never heard before, like Wipers, Savage Republic, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's easy to you know, sometimes mags definitely have their own perspective, and sometimes it can seem narrow, but you always can discover bands that you wouldn't expect, you know, elsewhere. I guess one of the other mags that was really influential for me was Force Exposure. I don't know if you're familiar with that magazine at all.
I'm not. I'm familiar with the Big Takeover, actually. Don't know Jack personally, but my mom is actually a friend of his too.
Oh, nice. Jack's a super nice guy. He's a great guy.
Yeah, I sat in on a panel once, and he was one of the speakers, just like super well spoken, super intelligent, just like kind of gets everything, and then just right out the door.
Yeah, he's a busy guy. Force Exposure was a very influential magazine for me too, that I discovered when I got out of college and moved to Boston, and then kind of backtracked my way into some of the back issues. But they covered a lot of stuff like, you know, the Sonic Youth, Big Black, kind of that real noisier end of rock, more, you know, that sort of thing. Jimmy Johnson still actually runs the Force Exposure mail order distribution company, and his counterpart Byron Coley. I don't know what Byron's up to these days. He does a little bit of writing here and there. He had a column in Spin back in the day. He used to write for New York Rocker. He used to contribute to, you know, a few different publications. But those two guys, I really like their writing style. Was pretty snarky. It's pretty much the opposite of Jack's. But they turned me on to a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, I'm just reading a little bit about it. It's corrosive yet humorous writing.
Yeah, they definitely made some enemies in their day, which may be why they don't bother putting up PDFs of the back issues. You can find some of them easy enough, but some of the early ones, like I think the first one or two had a Misfits cover. Some of those are really collectible and pretty pricey.
I'd just be interested in delving into it. So it's like a little part of, you know, music history that I'm not too familiar with. I like those little niche hidden stories there. So like I kind of had hinted at it before. I didn't hint at it. I flat out said it. You've been going to shooting shows as far back as 2006, according to your website. And like I said, I remember when Instagram, you know, first came out. Well, it wasn't really first came out, but I remember when it started picking up steam, it was kind of like towards, I don't know, maybe like I was probably like a junior in college. And then by like a couple years later, it was pretty big. And that's where I saw and found a lot of the photographers I followed that covered the heavy metal scene. And it seemed like all of a sudden heavy metal became a really cool thing to like photograph. And I can only imagine why. Like, what's the change been like for you over the years? Is it just like it is what it is, or like have you kind of enjoyed seeing how like the social aspect of it has sort of changed the way photography gets approached now?
That's a good question. There's a lot of parts to that. One thing I would say is that the way that I discovered music is so much different than the way that other people discover music now. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just different. You know, like I said, you go to the record stores, you trawl through the bins, you talk to people who work there. I did a bunch of mail order from various places. I remember I tracked down, I'm a big New Zealand music fan too. This label Flying Nun was a huge influence on my taste. And they released a lot of great records, but some of them were in tiny editions that really didn't leave New Zealand. So finding an original copy in the States was next to impossible. This was, you know, before eBay and any of that stuff. So I ended up tracking down a couple stores, and I bought records, via fax. And, those records I bought, 15, 20 years ago, some of them I've never seen another copy. So, you could probably go on Discogs now and find a copy. And, now this, 70s single from, random punk band is $150. Well, I'm not going to spend that, but it was nice to score a copy for $10 back in the day.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
The other thing about the socials is that it's definitely an easy way to get your work out there. And I do like Instagram as a platform. I kind of tie it in with Facebook, although for whatever reason, my Facebook and Instagram aren't synced properly. So I'm going to look into that. I look at it just as kind of like some people like to use it as a way to try to make money or get bands to hire them or whatever. And they get pissed when bands take their photos and post them without credit. If they send them, DMCA takedown notices or invoice them. It's like, I don't have time for that. I don't think that's the right way to go about it. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's nice to get credited, and I think bands should do that. But I'm not looking for $25 for some band to use a photo of mine that is on the channel for like a day or two and then disappears. It's social for a reason.
Sure.
The weird thing though is that Instagram, they don't have a functionality built in to easily regram an Instagram post. You have to use a third party, which maybe they're wary of like putting that in because then there could be some copyright implications. I'm not really sure, but it does seem a little weird that you can't just kind of repost easily. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Especially now that they're owned by Facebook, and Facebook is pretty much just like built on like sharing pages, to right. your friends, or sharing your business post, or like, in your case or my case, like sharing pictures or podcast update or something like that. And yeah, it is strange. It does seem like something that they would implement now given the ownership change, but I don't know. That's the entire reason why the syncing doesn't work well, because of it's just a thing they haven't figured out as a company. They're wasting too much time doing other things.
trying to make Zuckerberg more money.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing about Instagram is that, you know, now, you know, I'm just making this number up, but maybe, I don't know, 70 or 80% of the time that somebody sees a photo of mine, it's on their phone screen rather than on a computer screen.
Right.
And when I'm editing my photos, I'm on a, you know, a decent sized monitor, or, you know, it's 4K, 27 inch monitor. You see tons of detail. And the screen, sometimes you're like, I just pitch photos because I blew focus, or maybe it's a little too noisy. There's, you know, there's a lot of noise in the shadows and kind of looks like shit on my screen. I mean, 90% of the time I could probably just post that same photo on Instagram and it would look perfect. Nobody would ever see any of those flaws.
No, I think you're 100% right. And even with like their zoom function, you wouldn't be able to tell because the zoom function is like pretty bad anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, but then again, there's something about seeing a photo in a larger format that is, you know, it's a little bit more of an immediate response. You know, I don't print much of my work, but when I did that fundraiser for Matt Pike, you know, I got to see all these prints in pretty good sizes, and it's like, oh yeah, these things look pretty fucking good.
You are right, though. I do see, like, and of course you're right. I sold you. I think I found you like on Instagram, but it's a world of difference if you go onto just Tim's website and look at his portfolio, and you know, you see all these pictures.
Speaking of that, my portfolio was woefully out of date. I think the latest photo is from 2013, so I've been telling myself I need to update that for years, but I'll get around to it sooner or later.
Oh no, your picture portfolio is good. Your blog might be a little bit late.
the blog is like, yeah, kind of like stillborn. It hasn't really moved on that. I mean, what I tend to do is I use my website as an archive, so I've got folders sorted by year, and any show I shoot, I'll put up gallery for each of the bands. So, you know, but the portfolio should be a vehicle to showcase what I would consider my best work. And like I said, I need to update that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm thinking your archives then. Well, yeah, you should regardless go check it out. Cause there's some iconic stuff in there, and I guess we'll get into that now. Again, you know, you cover, you know, a big spectrum of bands, and, you know, bands relevant to this podcast, you know, bands like Sleep and Neurosis and Electric Wizard. Then you have pictures of The Who and Courtney Barnett and Wilco. And like, kind of the last question, like kind of pertaining to your taste in music, you know, do you think like now in 2020 that there's not enough time in the day to say, I only listen to X?
I've never been, you know, like just focusing on one particular music. So for me, yeah, I don't think I could ever listen to just, you know, one genre. I think there's always interesting music being played in a variety of things. And even like some stuff I would never normally shoot, like, you know, pop music or electro music. Sometimes from a visual perspective, it's actually fun to shoot. It's a bit of a different look and gets you out of your comfort zone a little bit. Not to say I would ever buy a record from those people and listen to it at home, but from behind the camera, it's, you know, there could be worse things.
Who was the first band you shot?
First band I shot was the Bats. Well, sorry, let me rewind a little bit. I did take a point and shoot film camera to a couple of gigs in the 90s. I think I shot some photos at a Zenigeva. I'm probably butchering that pronunciation, that noise rock band from Japan, one of their gigs. And I think Gas Heifer was on the bill too. And I don't know if I took my camera to the Belter Space show or not. I think a friend of mine took some photos because I was interviewing those guys. But the first one I did for real with a decent camera was the Bats. They were a New Zealand pop band. And the bass player, Robert Scott, also plays with a band called The Clean, which were a hugely influential band for New Zealand back in the early 80s. And again, it was this little club where you just kind of stroll in, and there's no, you know, you don't need a photo pass, or that, you know, security doesn't give you a hard time. So that's kind of how I cut my teeth, just bringing my gear into clubs that, you know, nobody cared. There's no photo pit. There's no 3-song limit. You know, you don't want to be an ass and shoot flash the whole show, but it was a good way to learn how to take photos and you know, just what to, you know, how to time things, how to look for stage lighting changes, just how to act in general. Because people, I get it. People, you know, photographers aren't always the most welcome people in crowds too, especially, and I'm very self-confident, I'm self-conscious of this. If you're in a small club and there's like five photographers at the front of the stage and there's like 100 people in the club, well, you know, it just feels a little weird. So if I'm in situations like that, usually I'll shoot for a couple songs and just kind of put my gear away and just enjoy the show.
Yeah, I've definitely run into that, where it's been like quite a few people or just a couple of, even if it's just a smaller room and there's just like two or three people shooting and, you know, it's not a packed house, it can seem a little bit like a little bit much. Like like you're not there to really enjoy the, like, what's going on. Cause I feel like that's definitely something I'm trying to learn how to balance when I shoot shows, is like, when is it like time to like take a picture? When is it time to like kind of just, you know, step back and enjoy what you're experiencing.
Right. And you don't want to feel like you're being a distraction to the other people who are there to see the band too. You know, it is a little bit of a tricky balance. You don't want to get good shots, but you don't want to be, you know, a component of the evening. You want to be as invisible as possible.
Right. Exactly. That's, I'm working on that.
Yeah. I mean, and it's tough. I mean, I've probably been that obnoxious person a few times, and, you know, people grumble when they're leaving the show. Who's that asshole? You know, I try not to do that, but sometimes I'm sure it's happened.
I think asking for like a real comprehensive list of, you know, your favorites or what you think is your best is like a bit much. But to you, I guess, kind of like just, you know, in this moment, you know, what are some of your fondest memories, and, you know, what do you consider some of the best shots that you've taken at shows? I guess this would be a way of asking, like, what do you think are like the best shows you've been to? But I guess that could be apples and oranges.
It can. Yeah. Sometimes there's shows that I really liked that I don't feel like I did great, you know, photography wise, and vice versa. I think at the top of my list would be the Iommi picture I got back in, I think it was 2009, maybe 2010. It was on the last tour that Ronnie did with Heaven and Hell. Mm-hmm. And there was a part where Tony came up pretty close to the stage and the stage lighting was good and he had his hands in a good position. I was able to get a good shot of his, you know, it looked like his original SG. I don't know if it was or not, but it looked pretty freaking old. With the custom inlay frets, that's still the largest photo I've ever printed. I have a print copy hanging up in my apartment now. That's definitely up there. I've gotten a lot of shots I like of Matt and Al, and to a lesser extent Jason, because sometimes the light is pretty rough in the back of the stage. But I've shot Sleep you know, a bunch of times, so I should have some good shots I like from them. There's a couple of bands that I always like to shoot, and they're difficult to shoot, but it's almost like you're playing, not cat and mouse, but one of them is, Refused. You know them at all? The Swedish, hardcore band.
I've seen them. I've seen them a couple of times. They were a band that, my friend was really into in high school, and they pretty loudly broke up. It was a pretty
bitter split.
Yeah, like they made a documentary about it. They were very much like, we're done. And then lo and behold, they ultimately did wind up coming back. I never saw them before that, but when I saw them after, I wouldn't know what to compare it to. I know some people weren't crazy about their reunion, but that dude is an incredible front man.
He really is. Yeah, I mean, I can't believe he doesn't split the ass of his custom, you know, suits all the time, because he's jumping around like a, you know, a scalded cat. And their stage lighting is difficult because it's usually pretty backlit and strobe lit, and he's usually wearing a dark suit. So locking focus on him is pretty tough. The other band I always will shoot, no matter what's going on in town, is any band that has David Yao in it, because David Yao is amazing.
Now, I'm not too familiar with David Yao.
He started in this band called Scratch Acid, Texas band that was kind of heavily influenced by early Nick Cave, you know, like Birthday Party, you know, pre Bad Seed stuff. And then they put out a couple records in EP, and then they split up, and then he and the bass player, David Sims, joined up with a couple guys, and they formed the Jesus Lizard.
Okay. Now I know who he is.
And yeah, the Jesus Lizard were fucking amazing. I mean, if I could set a time machine to shoot a band now, I think I did get to see them, you know, fairly early on. I saw them on the GOAT tour, but obviously I wasn't taking photos. I would love to shoot them, and I would love to shoot like prime Butthole Surfers when they had the two drummers and the Naked Dancer going. Yeah, pretty. Those two bands were pretty incredible.
Obviously, you know, your photography with Sleep is pretty legendary to like me and all the other fans online. So that actually will kind of like come back up in a minute. So another aspect I like about your website is that you have a bunch of offstage photos, which are looked to be like, you know, promo shots, but also just kind of like some captured in the moment. So I was just going to spout off a few and just see if you could provide any context for them. And I'll do my best to describe them to the listener. So like the first one is just a group shot of Church of Misery. It looks like they're either on way to performing, or they're just hanging out somewhere.
Yeah, that was at the first Roadburn I went to in 2012. And yeah, they were just kind of hanging out outside in the courtyard between O13 building and the Head Patronaut. And I like that shot a lot because the smoke motion, you know, coming from one of the guy's mouths, you know, when he's smoking a cigarette, it's got a kind of a good feel to it.
Going to be seeing them in a few weeks.
Nice.
Looking forward to seeing them. They're always a good time. Roadburn's obviously coming up too. And last year, I think another thing that really like, actually I want to credit it to you, but one of the bands I saw at Roadburn last year from the coverage, and I was like, ooh, I have to see this band, was the band Hylung. And I went to go see them over the weekend in New York, and it was freaking crazy. Like, yeah, it was bananas. I've never seen anything like that before.
They do the whole ritualistic thing like pretty well. I mean, there are some other bands that kind of move in that same territory as well. But I was really fairly unaware of their whole stage setup before I got there. And yeah, it was a very impressive show for sure.
Yeah, and when you just see something like so dynamic like that presentation, I was like, what is this? I need to know what this is. So thank you. Another one from your offstage is Alan Vega of Suicide, which I mentioned he just passed away not too long ago.
Yeah, that was at the second ATP I went to in New York, 2009. And yeah, he was just hanging out in the lobby. And I asked him if I could get a photo of him, and he said, yeah, sure. And he kind of leaned back a little bit. I like this pose a lot. You know, to be honest, when I'm shooting people off stage, I'm kind of terrible at giving direction and telling people what to do, which is something I want to work on a bit better. Because when you're shooting music, you have no control over anything. You don't say where people are going. You have no say over what the lights are doing. It's all reactionary. But when you're crafting a photo off stage, you have all those variables that you can control. To an extent, obviously, but yeah, I was happy with the way he posed. There's certain artists who you can tell are comfortable in front of a camera, and then there's others that aren't. Now, others that may not really care, but they don't know what to do. So you know that you've got that kind of wide range of people you're working with.
Sure, and I'm sure you didn't have any control of the next picture. As far as I know, probably the most well-known picture of the guy, but picture of Matt Pike with the Jameson bottle.
Yeah, that was from that first Roadburn too, and that was fun. They were just hanging out backstage after the show, and Pike was happy, and you know, just had a bottle of the whiskey, and yeah, it was a good moment. That was I feel fortunate that the band kind of, you know, gave me the access and all the opportunities that they have over the years. Because, you know, they're not a very open band in that regard a lot. They don't do a lot of press. They don't give a lot of photo passes out. So, you know, I do feel very fortunate that they gave me the opportunities that I've gotten.
Yeah, we're very thankful that, you know, you share them with us and we get to see them. I mean, did you ever think that you'd wind up going to the dude's wedding?
No, that was pretty much of a mind fuck. And, I shot Al's wedding too a couple of years ago. You know, I saw Al at Roadburn when the Roses was playing, and he asked me, he's like, oh yeah, Amy and I are getting married. I don't know any other photographers. Would you want to shoot my wedding? I'm like, of course I would.
Oh, very cool.
So then I was joking with Jason. I'm like, hey, Jason, you and Aaron have to renew your vows so I can shoot that too, and I can get the trifecta.
Now, this picture, it's pretty widely circulated the internet, and it's been turned into different artwork. It's been photoshopped. It's been memed. Like, how do you feel about all that? I kind of know because you said, you know, you're talking about people, you know, charging bands like with the cease and desist or something like that for not crediting them. So I guess I kind of understand how you feel.
Yeah, if people want to make a meme out of it, that I have no problem with that. It's just it's almost like hip hop and sampling some music is how I see it. It's just you're creating a different modification of the original, or using a part of a source to create something new. That's fine. It's funny that this photo comes up because just today, a photographer in Germany who I met last year gave me a heads up that somebody was selling some shirts, online. And the guy actually, to his credit, you know, I sent him an email through that little form on the store, and he got right back to me. He's like, you know, I didn't know it was a pro photo. I just did it for a little podcast. And I'm like, you know, that's fine. I'm not looking for, you know, you're not making 1,000 copies of the shirt and selling it. It was just for, you know, some French podcast. So I told him to just send me a couple shirts and we'll call it even.
Nice. All right. That sounds like a good deal. Mudhoney doing some record shopping.
Oh yeah. That was at In Your Ear. And that was right after I interviewed Steve and Mark. And that is one of my all time favorite interviews. Those guys were really funny. It was a good interview. And since the record store was like three doors down from the Paradise, I decided to get, go down there and do a quick shoot. And that was fun. We were in the store for probably like 45 seconds, but I do like that photo.
It's a great photo. And Mudhoney is awesome.
Yeah, they are good. Yeah. If that was on the Big Takeover. So if you haven't seen that interview, definitely check it out. It's, you know, I don't want to pump my work up too much, but I think those guys had some pretty funny answers. The other two interviews that I really enjoyed a lot were the first time I interviewed the Melvins at the Paradise. Buzz and Dale were on a tear. I've interviewed Buzz a few times, but that time was really, really good. And then I spent, I don't know how much, like 45 minutes talking with Mike Watt at 1ATP in England. And you know Mike Watt, the guy from Minutemen? And
yeah, and he went to play Fire Hose. He went to play with Iggy Pop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, dude, he is such a beautiful human being. Really open, honest, you know, no bullshit. Just a normal dude. And just talking with him was just so much fun.
I believe it. Yeah, it's always a little reassuring when you're like, oh, okay, you're just like the rest of us.
Exactly. And you know what? I get it. Sometimes, you know, maybe somebody's not having a great day and they're not in the right mood. And, you know, you don't want to be judging, you know, people, and I'm not calling them celebrities, but, you know, musicians or people that they have some public profile. You can't really judge them on just like one count, you know, chance encounter. If the person's a dick like 3 or 4 times, well, then yeah, there's a trend. But, you know, I hate when people are like, just because the person didn't do what they thought they should, then, oh, that guy's an asshole. You know, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's like I'm just trying to get some coffee, like not the time to do it.
Exactly. Well, it's funny because when I was on tour with Sleep last year, I learned of the term Punisher, which is what, you know, they call people who like kind of glam on people and they just want to talk and talk and talk and not let the person about what they were trying to do. You know, I get that.
Yeah, it's like that weird line where it's just like, you know, I'm sure most people are content with just like a hi, big fan of your work, keep up the good work, and, you know, just kind of move on or whatever. It's like, because, you know, you don't, it's like you live in a different bubble when you go up on that stage. It's like once you go up there, you know, you're in like a different like world, even if you don't think you are, but to other people because of, you know,
well, the worship other thing too status is like and people, silly stuff, you know, like that. And myself included, you form these associations with the music and the person, and they don't know fuck all about you.
Right, exactly. That's a really good way of putting it. All right, well, moving on from there. We got Todd Trainer from Shellac. Shellac was a band that I kind of like cut my teeth with a little bit in college to kind of understand like where, you know, the values of like good production and whatnot were coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love pretty much everything about how Shellac approaches and delivers their music. You know, there's no pretense. You know, they just form, you know, a straight line across the stage, pretty much, just white light. You know, there's no, I remember at one ATP, they started putting fog up on stage fog. Being like, no, stop that. This isn't a horror movie. Stop it. So, and I love shooting Shellac because Trainer is right there. You know, sometimes getting drummer shots are not the easiest, and I like to use a really wide lens sometimes to try to fill the frame and get as much as you can. And you can do that when the drummer is, you know, 4 feet away from you. When he's 20 feet away from you, you know, you really can't do much in that regard. But Trainer is a fantastic drummer. And I think the photo you're talking about was that was at one of the ATPs too. They were pretty much the house band at ATP. I think they played almost every event I saw.
Cool. And we got Doom icon Wino, just kind of hanging out in a courtyard or something like that.
Yeah, that was when I was leaving Roadburn. That was 2012 too. When he got the original lineup back together with Guy Pinhas and Greg. I think that's his name, the drummer. And he was checking out of the hotel the same time I was, and I just asked him if I could grab a quick shot, you know, of him. And he's like, yeah, just let me, you know, finish my stuff and yeah, we'll do it. And yeah, like I said, like, you know, 10 seconds, boom, photo done.
Just that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Just going back and looking at a couple more. See there, there's a picture of Warren Ellis, not the comic book writer, as a lot of people like to joke, but Warren Ellis, obviously of the Dirty Three and Nick Cave. Is this in Sydney?
No, that is in New York. That's in Manhattan. That was at the last.
I should know ATP. That skyline.
Yeah, it's right near. It is where Basketball City was. That's where they had the event. You know, on like near the FDR Expressway. Maybe it was just kind of near Chinatown a little bit. I think, but the Airbnb I stayed at was in Chinatown. But my friend Max and I did an interview with Warren, and then he did a quick pose for a shot. Warren is another great musician, great human. I just really like how he approaches life, his art. He's very thoughtful. He's very passionate. I don't know if you've ever seen The Dirty Three, but if you get a chance, do not pass go. Do not go home. Just go see that show, whatever you need to do. They're an amazing band.
I've seen Nick Cave like a bunch of times. And Warren is great with them, but I've never seen the Dirty Three, which was a band I really loved listening to in college, strangely enough, and just sort of fell out of touch with them.
It's tough now because I think Jim is living in New York, Warren's in France, and Mick is still in Australia, so they're pretty spread out.
I'd love to see another record from them, though. A lot of that music got me through some sad times in college. It was very it's very soothing. Probably music that, given, you know, what I listen to a lot and my taste, would probably be right at home in my my portfolio again.
Nice. Have you heard any of the soundtracks that Nick and he did? You know, for like the West Memphis 3 or the Road.
Not those. I know the one they've done for The Proposition.
Yeah, it's another good one.
which they wrote as well, and I love that movie. It's so good.
I haven't seen that movie. That's good. That's on my list.
It's a good one. It's a brutal, brutal, brutal Western, but it obviously takes place in Australia. And what's the other one? I did not see The Assassination of Jesse James, but I know they did that, the soundtrack for that as well. And then I did see the one with Tom Hardy. I think they did. I think they did the soundtrack for that one.
Okay.
That one was okay. That one was so-so.
Yeah. Yeah, they're but yeah, Nick Cave is another performer that actually let's talk about Nick for a little bit because
sure,
he is a guy from a fan perspective. I love seeing his shows. I mean, they're just full of energy. He really connects with the audience. You know, there's a real community feel, and his band is fantastic. But his photo rules drive me up a fucking wall. You know, I've shot him a couple times now, and you get the first song from one spot, and it's usually like a very sedate, low simmering, very low light number. And then you have to put your cameras away, and then he comes on like a fucking, a preacher from hell with, you know, brimstone and fire, and the whole band's crashing around him, and he's striding around and yelling, and, you know, it's just like, wow, how come I couldn't shoot that song? But then he likes to crowdsource, you know, people's phone photos from the front row, which I totally get. They're great photos, but it's like, well, why not just hire a tour photographer and let them get those shots, you know, in a better quality, better format, better, you know, whatever. It's, maybe he feels like having pro photographers at his show is interfering with his ability to project and perform somehow. I'm not really sure. I don't quite get it, but it's frustrating because you think of all the photos that you would love to get and you can't, unless you're going to try to drop, you know, the money on a front row seat somehow and smuggle a camera in.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like Jack White's philosophy. Like when I went to go see them last year, I had to like put phones in the bags and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm saying this as somebody who, you know, grew up with got the cell phone, you know, pretty young in age, and, you know, I have one on me at all times, just like everyone else. And there's so many things that I run out of it. Like, it was a fine experience, you know, it was like probably like 2 hours or whatever. And like, I'm saying this from like a very privileged place, but, you know, it was just like, oh, you know, don't, I'm not going to like worry about this thing or answering calls. I'm just going to enjoy the show. But at the same time, I was kind of like, they didn't do anything super crazy. They just sort of like played the show, and they had a lot of good energy, but it wasn't like he was conducting the audience the way that like Nick Cave does now, where he's just like, you know, he's just like, you know, like you said, standing before him like a hell preacher or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Jack's got a kind of a funny thing with cameras. And I know he has his own tour photographer that will give images to publications if they want to run it with a review, which, you know, that's fine. That's his prerogative to do. But I remember he played Newport a few years ago, Newport Folk Fest. And you could see that, you know, the dude does have a pretty big ego, because there was nobody allowed to shoot the show. Even the production people shooting for the festival couldn't shoot. But the thing that kind of got under my skin a little bit was when you go to Newport, it's all about the festival and what George Ween, you know, created, and the sense of community. And there's a lot of repeat bands and collaborations, et cetera. Well, there's always this big banner in the background at the main stage, which, you know, just as Newport Folk, it's got a bird with a guitar case. Well, when Jack came out, they replaced it with a much smaller version without any print. It was just a small image. And it's like, dude, really? You're going to dictate that too? Just fucking play your songs.
Jeez.
Yeah, I guess he can be a bit of a control freak, but, you know, there's a lot of good things about Third Man Records that he's done. And, you know, I don't want to come off as saying the guy's a complete jerk, but that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way when I saw that.
Well, it's just like, that's like his price. It's just like, I'm here. This is like what's bringing people to see, you know, your show is me. But, you know, at the same time, it's just like, you know, the concept of levity doesn't seem to exist there. So he's, you know, it's I could imagine, you know, it would be the same as if Prince was doing something, you know.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, you're right. You probably, you know, because you're right, Jack White could play a venue much, much larger than Newport. So it's like he did a favor to the festival by, you know, showing, by playing, and, you know, people loved his set. But then again, it's like, you know, maybe, you know, put your ego down a notch. Whatever.
Yeah. All that being said, I don't think it really, it doesn't eliminate the fact that, like, your ego is showing pretty hard. But, you know, it's just like, damn, the dude can the dude can play. Like, the dude is immensely talented. So it's understandable. Like, I get it. So I guess
About on that too is like, for my fellow photographers, sometimes people get kind of bitter about, you know, they're not approving anyone to shoot the show. You know, that's their choice. You know, Bob Dylan hasn't approved anyone to shoot a show in like 25 years. He doesn't need any photos.
So he's Bob Dylan.
So it's like, you know, just every time I get approved for photo pass, I'm like, okay, cool. If somebody wants me to take their photo, you know, it's like, it's a privilege. It's not an expectation.
Right. I 100% agree with that. So, and you know, I think maybe you could run the risk of, like, you know, you're sort of like not embracing what the show is about. You know, you get lost in your own thing. And
the show goes on regardless of whether I'm pressing the shutter or not. You know, you need a guitar tech, you need a sound guy, you need the band, you need all that stuff. If no cameras are anywhere near the building, the show's still going to happen.
Yep. And people are still going to remember it, and they're still going to talk about it.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, we can dive into the band of the week, which I was delving into today myself. They are a band from the UK called Arkham Witch. They've been around for a few years now, and as far as I know, they're still active. Not in your typical wheelhouse of doom metal. not the slowest of riffs. In fact, pretty fast. But for me, and I've listened to this band before, but it's nice to revisit them for a little while because, you know, sometimes it does get a little bit too slow around these parts. So it's nice to have like a good throwback band that also has like some cool doomy riffs. And I think they're just a lot of fun. I don't really know what they're up to, if they have another record in the works. But as far as I know, they are active. They actually did put out like an EP last year or 2 years ago.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about these guys, to be honest with you. So I fired up Spotify, you know, over the last few days and familiarized myself with them. And yeah, just from the name Arkham Witch, I figured they were, you know, into the whole, you know, Cthulhu mythos. Mm-hmm. And they definitely drop a lot of those references in their songs.
Oh yeah, it's like, you know, Arkham is the asylum in there, and like, I'm sure a witch, there's got to be a witch in Lovecraft. But yeah, I mean, it's just like ripped out, like right straight up from the Lovecraft mythos. Like, it's funny. I think they like spelled the name differently, probably to avoid like a copyright, and then it was just spelled the normal way, like in another song later. I kind of felt like, and I don't mean this in like a bad way, but like these guys are kind of like the misfits of doom metal. just like every like trope that they could do, but not horror from Lovecraft, is just checked off. But like, I mean, honestly, probably a better band than like technically than the Misfits.
Yeah, the Misfits aren't playing, you know, any kind of super technical music, but they're very, you know, they're very good anthems to sing along to. I thought some of the stuff that I heard was a little cheesy, a little corny, but my main complaint was some of the songs are just too long. It's like they kind of ran out of ideas, and they could have had a 4-minute song when they made a 7-minute song.
Right. I agree with that.
The one song that really kind of made me laugh a lot was the second to last song on the first record, Legions of the Deep. I'm looking on the Spotify listing now. We're from Keighley, which I guess is where they're from in England. And there's a town reference in the Lovecraft books, I guess, called Rila, like R apostrophe.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was like a riff on that, but I don't know if you heard those, if you know the song or heard the lyrics, but it's basically like an anthem for like where they're from. It's pretty funny. And
yeah,
very good use of the term motherfucker in that song too. And it really, really fits that tune.
Yeah, no, they're a lot of fun. They're very funny, and they're definitely, I would say, aware of what they're doing, you know, in terms of like this is, you know, we're not listening to fucking Perry Ubu here or something like that.
Right.
Or
even like Electric Wizard, that, you know, like Judge has this very, you know, his presentation is, you know, always like right there. It's very thought out, and, you know, he's trying to project a pretty serious tone where these guys are like, yeah, fuck it, let's have some fun.
Yeah, it's got that new, like, you know, new wave of British heavy metal vibe. Like, I, you know, you hear a lot of Maiden, you hear a lot of Priest.
Witchfinder General was like the first band that popped my head when I started listening
to them. Yeah, Witchfinder General. But then, you know, there's also some, like, you know, misfit punk riffs in there and like a little bit of like punk attitude. Like, I think kind of like that gross, you know, I've got like a mohawk and wearing this leather jacket kind of deal. And kind of like glam metal too. Like, I could see these guys like opening up for like, God, I don't even know. I don't know if they'd want to. Like, I could see them opening up for like Rat or something.
Yeah. Yeah, they would definitely, they could be a decent foil for a lot of different bills, really. I think, you know, it's because there's not a lot of bands that sound like them, so they could be a complimentary, you know, part to a variety of other bands.
Yeah. I think actually some of their more impressive songs were on their, like, I'm not caught up with my Lovecraft lingo, but I believe it's pronounced Thoth. I'm just getting tongue-tied. But they did like a three collections. That one was actually, I thought, pretty good in terms of like their evolution as a band. They're not relying too like strictly on like the Lovecraft stuff, and the stuff was getting a bit, it was a little doomier, a little heavier, so I was enjoying that aspect of it. But like in terms of songs that I really enjoyed, I like the song, I like their take on Reanimator. It was very funny. It had like kind of a, I don't want to say like a Ramones vibe, but it had like that era sort of punk vibe that it made it a lot of fun, and I could see it being in like the actual Reanimator movie.
Yep.
Which is pretty fun. I like the color Out of Space too. That was a good one.
Yeah, their song From Beyond is not the sleep song.
No, it's not. Yeah. But certainly drawing from similar influence. Although one thing I did notice was the guy in terms of singing, he kind of ranged from like these very crazy, like bombastic King Diamond-ish sort of vocals. But then on some of the later stuff, he almost had like an Ian Curtis, Fred Schneider sort of like hybrid. It was very strange.
I totally get what you're saying, because I listened to the first record first, the Legions of the Deep, and then I listened to I Am Providence, and I thought it was a different singer. I had to check Discogs to see who was on what lineup, but it's the same guy.
He's a pretty impressive vocalist for what they do. So, but yeah, I enjoyed them. They're definitely like a good band to just throw on if you're looking for something to, you know, listen to. I feel like this would be like a, hey, if you want to like start listening to like some heavy metal, you kind of like start with this, because it's familiar, but it's like a little bit weird that it's not, you know, it's not too hard for people to like, you know, wrap their heads around. Right. But yeah, fun. I could see him being in a movie.
Yeah, in the Ramones and the Misfits, you know, references were good. Another band that kind of, and I don't know these guys all that well, I've only seen them once, but another band that kind of gave me, you know, similar feelings was Acid Witch.
Yeah, I would say Acid Witch or, actually, I was also listening to that band Midnight today, and
Midnight fucking rule. I love those guys. They are one of the most fun bands to see. I get to see them twice this year, and I've seen them a couple times before that. And yeah, they're one of those bands that, like, if they're in a 50-mile radius, yep, I'm going to see them.
Unfortunately we couldn't make it work with just like, you know, traffic and getting to the venue on time. We went to go. We saw the Electric Wizard. When they hit New York, but we didn't see Midnight just because the timing wasn't going to work out, and we were kind of like, eh. But I got to say, the new album is really, really good. I really enjoyed it, and they seem like they're a pretty entertaining band with their very bizarre getup.
yeah, they are a fun band to see. Yeah, definitely put them on the list.
But just wrapping up with Arkham Witch, you actually can go support them over at arkhamwitch.bandcamp.com. And I guess that's going to actually kind of wrap us up here. And just before we, you know, close up, is there anything you'd like to plug, you know, your social media handles, website and all that?
You can find me under any variation of Tinnitus Photography. The Instagram is tinnitus_photo. I'm on Facebook. And like I said, I put up pretty much all my photo. Well, not all my photos, obviously, but I have galleries of pretty much every band I've shot, you know, since I started. So if anyone's got, you know, free time to dig through, there's thousands of photos to look at. Not to say that they're all worth looking at, but, you know, there might be a band that you've never seen photos of. I'm like, hey, that's cool. So dig in.
There you go. Oh, actually, one last question before we sign off. How'd you come up with the name Tinnitus? Because it's like genius to me.
Well, yeah. So for people who may not know, the tinnitus refers to ringing in the ears, you know, from prolonged exposure to excessive noise. And that is a occupational hazard of going to so many shows like I do. You know, I do wear earplugs pretty much most of the time, not all the time, depending on the show, but my ears are a little fucked. So if I'm in a crowded room with a lot of background noise and you're trying to talk to me, I might ask you to repeat yourself a fair bit.
I think it's fair to say a lot of us probably have that same issue, or at least developing it. I do feel that way myself.
Wear your earplugs, yeah. Kids out there. If you're in the 20s, wear your earplugs.
Yeah, wear your earplugs and get your orthotics.
Exactly, yes, absolutely. Well, Dylan, hey, thank you very much for inviting me on this podcast. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you, Tim. I really appreciate you coming on and telling us about your the life and times of being a concert photographer and all that. And this was great. Definitely hoping to run India at some point. I'm sure we will cross paths eventually again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Are you planning on going back to Psycho?
Not right now, because I'm going to be probably moving around that time. So I don't, it's not in the budget. Okay. For this year, unfortunately. So,
well, I'll be down in New York in May for the Current 93 show. So, maybe if you're free, maybe we'll grab a beer then.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. That would be cool. Are you thinking about coming down for Desert Fest, depending on the lineup?
Yes, that would definitely be a go, because it's later in the year now too. It's in September, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah. Desert Fest was fun. So I definitely like to get back there if I can.
Cool. Well, we'll keep in touch, obviously. And thanks again. And that will do it for this chapter of the diary.
Right on.